the original focus here in Marin Sangha in our first years was more how to live the Dharma in daily life, how to let the Dharma, the knowing, understanding, practicing of the Dharma, inform our daily lives in a way that our lives are more skillful, more compassionate, have more ease and joy. So it's applying, letting the Dharma live through us in daily life. We could call it walking around, mindfulness practice, if you like that. We could call it having a compassionate, intentional life. These kinds of orientation that was a part of our original idea with this Sangha. And so we've had many explorations of the Dharma in daily life through all of the many years now. And tonight, I would like to talk about authenticity and how the Dharma allows us to have a larger feeling of being authentic to ourselves, being authentic to others, having an authentic life, having a life that we feel whole, we feel complete in terms of our experience through our mindfulness, through our intention of compassion, and for metta, and so forth. One way to understand this is allowing the Dharma to empower us for that which we would choose, for the most part, not completely, but choose automatically if we felt safe enough to choose that, because who would not want to feel authentic to oneself? Who would not want to feel authentic with others when we feel safe enough to do so? Not always that we feel safe. Sometimes we need the facade, that extra degree of facade. We need to be a little unreal in a situation, or we just need to sort of vacate the body or something just to feel safe, because it's too much for some reason. It's just not safe. We don't feel accepted or so forth. This is a New Yorker cartoon from a couple of years ago, and it's the New Yorker does this series of cartoon where there's the wise man on the mountain and somebody's climbed all the way up to get some piece of wisdom, and in this instance it's a dog. And so the dog is sitting there looking at the monk sitting there, and the monk is saying, "The bone is not the reward. Digging for the bone is the reward." So, I don't know. You think that's true? So maybe both are true, actually. Maybe the digging is the biggest part. And first of all, the bone gives us purpose. And then the taste of the bone is its own reward. But the experience is whole, as authentic, because the digging was enough. So it is with practice. If the practice is enough, when we have those moments of letting go, when we have those moments of feeling free, of not being caught in wanting or aversion or any kind of delusion, then that's the taste of the bone. But the bone becomes problematic if it's only the taste of the bone. We need this sense of practice. The digging is the end, as my friend George Leonard, who no longer with us, but many of you have heard me say many times, that learning to love practice, learning to love the plateau of practice where nothing is happening, but we are practicing and learning to love practice in this way, and that makes practice authentic. We're being authentic in this moment in our practice if the practice is the reward. That's a moment of authenticity. Are we always going to be like that? It would be great if it is. But it doesn't have to be always. It's that orientation. It's that direction to our experience. Oh no, just practice. So I looked up this word authenticity in the dictionary before coming here, and it had a number of, it had very long definitions actually, and it started with saying possessing authority that is not usually open to challenge. Possessing authority. So for our purpose, what would be that authority? The authority of the sincerity of our practice. Not that we're perfect in our motivation, but that there's this general direction, this intention, as best I am able in this moment. When I remember, and I do intend to remember, that I wish to practice, I do intend to be authentic in my life through my mindfulness and through my metta and my compassion. I do intend to be authentic in my life. I don't always remember, but I intend to remember. And we are for real in that intending. We're for real. We're authentic. And then there's all these karmic conditions. Sometimes we remember, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we remember, but we're so overwhelmed even though we're remembering, we don't do it very well. We just can't be present very well. We're just too much going on. There's something that won't work in this moment. Because we're upset or because of physical pain or some sense of having lost confidence in ourselves or something like this. These things happen. These things are part of practice. They're not the exception to practice. They're not excluded in practice, but we practice with those things too. And that's part of this authenticity, is our sincerity in being with everything, even those moments when we have a terrible relationship with the breath. For some reason, we can't be with the breath. Where it's upsetting to be with the breath. It brings up all of our emotions, everything that I was describing in the extra long guided meditation that I did, because I really wanted us to see that we can have a mindful relationship with how we're relating to breath, that we can really know this. Oh, wow, this is going on with me in breath, as opposed to just I'm with breath or not with breath, or I'm sort of with breath, or what all that, that's of the breath is low, deep, shallow, fast, slow. All of this is a very good practice, but also understanding the way we're relating to experience. We can use our most basic practice to see how we relate to experience. And if we start with breath and we can see how we're relating to the breath, then we can see how we're relating to a moment when someone's hurt our feelings, or when we feel really disappointed, or that we don't know what to do. We can see how we're relating to, I don't know what to do. Knowing how we're relating to, I don't know what to do, changes how we're being with, I don't know what to do. That's authenticity. So possess an authority that is not usually open to challenge. Another one is worthy of acceptance or belief by reason of conformity to fact and reality. Sort of long-winded to say, yeah, I'm not just saying this, I'm really walking my talk as best I'm able. And I don't need to exaggerate how much I'm able to walk my talk. I am walking my talk. I intend to walk my talk. Again, this is the key, this sense of commitment. And then, so We're in line with it. Who can know this? Most of all, ourselves. Sometimes a teacher or a friend can help us and say, hey, you know, I don't feel as though you're walking your talk so well. I don't really feel the authenticity in this. But sometimes not. A couple of months ago, I was in a situation in which I felt as though I'd really acted unskillfully in speech. And it was really distressing to me. I thought it was really poor speech. And so I immediately asked the person who was the recipient of my poor speech for forgiveness. I actually bowed and asked for forgiveness. And someone else that was present said, Philip, You are the person that is most in their body of anyone that I ever have known. And you weren't in your body when you were doing that. It did not feel sincere to me. And I said, so it's true, I was not in my body. That was true, because I was so upset. But that did not mean that I was not sincere in the asking for forgiveness. Do you see the difference? Mm-hmm. So in that moment, I who have spent so many years, so many hours upon hours upon hours, really, like, it would be hard for you to believe the degree that I have been committed to occupying with awareness this body, in that moment, I had lost my connection to it. Not pleasant. But it was the truth of my experience. I was being true to my experience. I was being authentic. But I was distressed with myself. And so in that moment of distress, I was not... had I waited longer to do that, maybe I would have. Maybe not. Maybe it would have gotten worse. But that happened to me. It happened as an experience. Why am I willing to share this? Because I would want you to see me in my wholeness. And when I'm playing the role, when I'm wearing the robe of the teacher, only as a robe, not a me, I'm not a teacher. I am teaching. I'm a practitioner who's teaching in this moment. But I would have you know me in my wholeness, not in the way when I'm, you know, and on my center, in the center. I don't have that kind of a need. My need is actually for you to see me in the totality of my experience. That to me is being authentic. That's being authentic. What allows me to do that is the practice. Because I can stay present. I can stay in the body. I can stay connected to my intention. I can be mindful of whether or not I'm living my intention. And I have a series of skillful means that we've all learned in the Dharma, and you'll keep learning over and over again because we repeat all these skillful means endless times because we need it that many times, that allows me to be able to do this. So the Dharma is allowing me to be who I would wish to be had I never heard of the Dharma, because I always wanted to be authentic. Always wanted to be. Do you start to see the connection here? I often talk about that mindfulness equals being present, and being present gives us a presence, and that presence has that sense of connectedness, of authenticity. So that this is coming at the same way of understanding practice that I'm fond of doing and often do. A third definition is vested legally. And I was asking myself, how does that apply? And the only thing that I came up with is, yeah, I've put my butt in the chair or on the cushion. That's the legality. That there has been some demonstration of my commitment to authenticity. And that gives the authority of authenticity because of a degree of practice and then a willingness to own and correct as best I'm able. That's the kind of feeling of that. And then a fourth one was not imagined, but rather real. So real rather than imagined. And it's painful to see someone who has developed so much protection for themselves that you can feel them, their lack of their own authenticity, and realize, oh, at this moment they can't. They can't feel it for themselves because it's just all too much right now. There's been too many years of needing to create too solid of a persona, of a false self that we do. And more as false self than a persona. I don't really want to use the word persona that way, so I want to lift that back a little. But more that this, that where we know we're being a false self, so and then we cease to know that it's false. We start believing our own falseness. Really not pleasant. Although the reason that we succumb to that in part is because we hate feeling false. So we start fooling ourselves, or we do it so often we lose our own track, or we get rewarded for our false self so much that we kind of get swept up into it. A version of, you know, believing your own press clippings. So this sense of realness. And realness is beautiful, not because it's pleasant necessarily, not even skillful, but at least it's real. And if it's a realness that's open to feedback, both inter between you and another, and intra between within ourselves, that kind of realness both ways, then it creates a dynamic. Boy, does the metta help with that. Boy, does the compassion practice help with that. Boy, does learning how to develop sympathetic joy make a difference. Because we don't have to be unreal when someone tells us their happiness. We are truly happy for them because we've developed that capacity within us. And so with equanimity, that we can stay equanimous in tough times, we can stay more real with ourselves. And it's not an all at once. This is a lifetime's practice where we're not going any faster than we can go given the conditions and circumstances of our lives. Another definition was not copied, but was authentic. It's not, so you're not copying someone else. You don't have, you know, at some point, like if you're a poet, you first borrow some style of writing poems, or as a songwriter, you write some style, or a speech writer, or the way you play basketball or tennis or whatever you do, the way you cook, you may have imitated someone. But at some point, you're cooking your style, your way. This is the way you cook. So it's not copied, although we have all sampled, you know, just like in the music world, we all have sampled and continue to sample from everybody we've ever been exposed to in some way and forms. Us, we just do that, we sample, but nonetheless, there's a sense of, oh no, this is now the way I do it. When we're learning something new, we're doing a lot of copying. So the authenticity there is, I'm copying because I don't know how to do. But then at some point, we start knowing, and we know that difference. Everybody in this room knows that difference. Don't need to describe that. And the last definition that was there was an origin that cannot be questioned. An origin that cannot be questioned. So it's authentic, you know, like with painting, you know, there's been all these recent scandals of paintings that were authenticated that were not real. There's been these huge lawsuits, and some of them are getting settled now. In one instance, this woman from Long Island kept selling at this ridiculously low prices to this gallery in Manhattan these paintings by famous artists, and then the gallery was selling them at prices that, if they were real, would have been the right price, but somehow didn't realize that maybe there's a little problem here. So it turned out there was this very talented Chinese guy living in Queens who was doing all these different styles. That's not authentic. Just in case you have a question. So in our own creativity, we can worry about being authentic. We can worry about it in our personality, the way we interact with others. We can worry about it with our own relationship to ourselves. We can have all of this, you know, my jiving myself about how I deal with, you know, vulnerability or the truth of my debt that is just around some corner. Am I faking my relationship, or is this authentic? Again, it's this intention, it's this movement towards being authentic, not, oh, I am absolutely authentic in every moment. You know, would seem to me, from my life experience, and then working with actually a fairly large number of people now, that it's far safer to take this position of my aspiration towards authenticity than believing that I'm never, you know, I'm never just full of it, you know? Because in any given moment, we can just be unreal with ourselves, you know, or be unreal with another, or be unreal with ourselves and another. The mindfulness allows that to be okay, this compassionate mindfulness. Oh boy, I don't feel safe enough. I'm so wanting to be liked or pleased, or I'm feeling competitive in this moment. So I'm presenting myself in such a favorable light that it's a bit of a stretch beyond, you know, and to have a certain degree of amusement about that. And but then, when can I stop doing this? You know, when is it okay for me to stop? Oh, I did this the last conversation with this person. Now here I'm having lunch with them again. I do not want to present an unreal aspect of myself in order for them to like me, respect me, listen to me, to compete with them, whatever. I don't want that. I would rather not be respected. I'd rather not be liked. I'd rather not be listened to than be unreal. This doesn't mean in lots of situations in life that we don't present what we believe or what we're wanting someone to do in the most favorable light. That's different. Just the other day, goodness, I can't even remember the situation. Don't remember at all, but somebody was in one of my life balance sessions was talking about the pressure that someone was putting on them to present the facts in a way that weren't quite true. And I said, don't do it. Don't do it. Just do not do that. If they fire you, don't do it. Do not lie. It is not worth it. You can, again, present it as positively as you can, but don't lie. You lose too much. What you gain is not worth it. Would that be true in every single situation? No, maybe. I would if I were protecting Jews in Nazi Germany, I'd lie my head off, you know? I'd lie my head off, and because there was a greater truth I was serving. But that would not be the truth of gaining a little more advantage in the world, if you see the difference. So it's not an absolute, and the being authentic, it's not like rigid rules. It's not that kind of a relationship to the authentic. It's towards the wholeness of the experience, but not rationalizing either. So I would add, from my point of view, a definition of authentic, which showed up later in the dictionary, but I would add, as in that list, is being authentic, meaning being authentic to one's values, what one generally cares for, that one lives from their values, what one genuinely cares about. I would call that authenticity, and maybe the most relevant to us here. So, a poem by Clive James. Your death, near now, is of an easy sort. I'm sorry, I should have told you the name of the poem because that would make a huge difference. Start over. Japanese Maple is the name of the poem. Your death, near now, is of an easy sort. So slow a fading out brings no real pain. Breath growing short is just uncomfortable. You feel the drain of energy, but thought and sight remain. Enhanced in fact, when did you ever see so much sweet beauty as when the fine rain falls on that small tree and saturates your brick back garden walls? So many amber rooms in mirror halls. Even more lavish as the dust descends, this glistening illuminates the air. It never ends. Whenever the rain comes, it will be there, beyond my time. But now I take my share. My daughter's choice, the maple tree, is new. Come autumn and its leaves will turn to flame. What I must do is live to see that. That will end the game for me, though life continues all the same. Filling the double doors to bathe my eyes, a final flood of colors will live on as my mind dies, burned by my vision of a world that shone so brightly at the last and then was gone. He's in the process, some of you may know his work and know that he's in the process of dying, and he's written these kinds of poems here. Clive James. Yeah. So, one area where the wiki gets sticky is in relation to desire. Desire, ironically, because it can be a very real desire, and yet it leads to so much unrealness, you know, to get the desire we want. Sometimes it's because it's a desire that we should not be seeking to fulfill, and we know it. So we are already unreal with ourselves in trying to justify it, or going to this nothing matters anyway, this kind of nihilism that the Buddha warned us about. And so it can be instructive in small ways to see if we can stay authentic to ourselves around this many, many flows of desire in a day. In the since mid-January, a little after mid-January, I had a oral surgery on my upper left side, and I'd had a tooth pulled in the summer, and the idea was to put in an implant, and to do so, because of the particular bone structure I had, it was deemed necessary that the sinus be lifted, and then a fair amount of artificial, a calf bone or pig's bone or something put in, and then the fastener for the insert be added. And something went terribly wrong, and maybe it was that the membrane of the sinus was pierced. I don't know, and I'm not going to ever know. But something went really wrong, and so for now, over a month, I have had a lot of sharp pain. It is less in the last 2 days than it has been all this time, but I had a huge amount of pain for a month, just a huge amount of pain. And it was so much that it would break my attention. I am a person who, by nature and by all these years of practice, my attention is pretty continual on whatever I am focused on. I don't actually have stray thoughts. It makes me not so good at multitasking, by the way. But I really, like, I'm just there. And I've had this experience of this month of having these constant interrupts of that kind of an experience. It has required me to, first of all, to report this with people I'm with, because my way that I have viewed myself as being authentic is that I'm really there with you. I'm not really somewhere else. I'm there with you. Not always, but a great deal of the time. I mean, way, a huge percent. And so here I was not being like that. My mind would go off and deal with my pain and then come back. I tried not letting my mind go off. But the trouble with that is then the pain would build. And it would, then I would have this more difficult situation that eventually would win the day. So I would report my experience, and I had to get used to being this sort of I don't know, what do you call it? Wavering focus, wavering attention. I really don't know. It's not. And so this has been part of my experience. And then at the same time, for that, at times I had to take heavy-duty painkillers, which I've never really done. I've had like maybe two in my entire life until this experience. And Which, by the way, I don't see why people would get addicted to those things, because I missed the high of them, or whatever you're supposed to get into them. All it did was make my mind fuzzy. But it did help at the time with the pain. I didn't have to do that if I was going to just be with the pain. But I could not function at all at times unless I did something. And I chose, it was my desire to continue function, to meet my responsibilities. The most I've been able to do is a half day, really, at a time. And sometimes after 2 hours, I'd be exhausted. So I had to, I rested before I came here tonight because I have no energy. So at the same time, taking these pills made my mind less like it is ordinarily. So my mind was not my mind. And so to see, oh, we've got a little attachment here, do we, Philip? There's a little attachment. And that was the practice. And so confused things, like last Saturday night, I was going to be the surprise guest at the Marin party. I was there on 5th Street in San Rafael and could not find the place, because I thought I knew where it was, because my mind was fuzzy. I was really having a bad day. And it was, because I'd had to do some things in the afternoon, and I only had one person's phone number with me, and their phone didn't work. One of the Sangha members, their phone didn't work there. So I was driving up and down the street. So, and I had only a limited amount of time. So I didn't get to come to the party. So I really apologize to all of you for that. I really wanted to be there. And again, to see like what was going to be my relationship, because I felt like I was letting you down. But also, I had a story, right? Mm-hmm. About I was going to just show up, because those of you who are regulars know that I never go to any party. This would be like headline in Philip's life. He went to that party. So my desire, I couldn't fulfill my desire. And then I was watching my relationship with this whole experience in relation to how authentic was I staying with myself. Do you see what I mean? So like I would make up all these rationalizations about this or that so I could feel better, da, 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 da. Oh, I was going to be there early and most of the people weren't going to be there early. And you know, I mean, it was just amazing to watch my mind make up these stories so that it could sort of self-assure itself. And having to say no, no, no. It's like this, you know. And so that's an example again from my own life. Again, using my own life for you to feel the authenticity of my own experience, and not that it's some theory talking to you, some sort of thing that I don't engage in myself, to model the very thing we're talking about. In Emotional Chaos to Clarity, I got into this a bit, and when I was teaching from Emotional Chaos to Clarity, I got more into it, and I wanted to bring it up here, which is this idea of a coherent authenticity. And the coherent authenticity is, for me, a connected, integrated authenticity, so that it's got a through line to it, so that it's not... There's many aspects of all of us, right? There's just many different aspects. But there can be the way we're relating to those different aspects can have an internal coherency. So just as I was asking you to see how you were relating to your breath. You're relating to your breath, you're relating to your partner, you're relating to your spouse, you're relating to your children, you're relating to your dog, you're relating to someone in the supermarket, someone you work with, to your boss, to a parent. there is that the way you're making these relationships, that even though they're very different and different aspects of you come out with different things we want, there's still some through line of coherence to a deeper set of values. This is what I mean by a coherent authenticity. Clear enough? I'll take questions just a moment. And so it's congruous with some values or some principles. It's integrated. It's although the parts are very different, they are interrelated, those parts. So there's with each aspect of ourselves, there's an intra-authenticity, the authenticity of that part of us as a mom, you know, as a worker, as whatever it is, a service person, and if you're going off somewhere to be of service, whatever it is, that there isn't that. There's also inter between the different aspects of ourself a kind of coherence. This isn't something that gets said very often. So it's not unusual to see people not have an intercoherence to different aspects of themselves. This is just not said that much. It's just not. So people you would think would have that, because you know them in one way, but then when you know them more, it's less. And I don't mean some set of somebody else's moral values imposed on you. I mean your values as you're living. Others might go, that contradicts this, but it may not to you. So I'm not talking about something imposed, but some choice from your own life experience, this coherent authenticity. There's something which I know almost nothing about, called coherent theory, is that ultimate criteria of truth is the coherence of its separate parts with one another and with experience. So it's different parts, it's all connected. I can see some puzzlement out there. How to say this? So there's your truth. Your truth, whatever your truth is, has different parts. So if your truth, if looked at as one aspect of you, it would be like this. There's another part of you that the truth would be, you just state it differently because it's different. You as a mom or a brother or a sister or a lover, there's different truths that we have. We all are like that. But this coherent theory is that being authentic, for my word, not truth, but the coherence, that this coherence is what makes us this authenticity, this sincerity. This is by Naomi Shihab Nye. It's called Famous. And treat that word famous as a gateway and not as a hard thing, okay? So you have to understand what famous means. Don't assume we know what she means for this poem. The river is famous to the fish. The river is famous to the fish. The loud voice is famous to silence, which knew it would inherit the earth before anybody said so. The cat sleeping on the fence is famous to the birds watching him from the birdhouse. The tear is famous briefly to the cheek. The idea you carry close to your bosom is famous to your bosom. The boot is famous to the earth, more famous than the dress shoe, which is famous only to floors. The bent photograph is famous to the one who carries it, and not at all famous to the one who is pictured. I want to be famous to shuffling men who smile while crossing streets, sticky children in grocery lines, famous as the one who smiles back. famous as the one who smiles back. I want to be famous in the way a pulley is famous, or a buttonhole, not because it did anything spectacular, but because it never forgot what it could do. I want to be famous in the way a pulley is famous, or a buttonhole, not because it did anything spectacular, but because it never forgot what it could do. That's authenticity to me. Naomi Nye,
NYE.
Naomi
Shunham.
Yeah. NAOMISHIHABNYE. So this is what I mean by the authenticity, that we want to be real to ourselves in our flow of experience. The Buddha teaches us that there's not anything that's unchanging in our experience. Our experience is always changing. So being authentic to that flow of experience and how we relate to it, because we will relate different ways, but if we're always being authentic, if we're always coming from this set of values as best we're able, then maybe we're famous to it, to the flow of our own experience. Huh? Maybe one way to think of this. It is not easy being a human being, in case any of you didn't notice. It is not easy being an adult. It's not easy being a child, but it's different not being easy being an adult for many reasons. But one of them is how easy it is to give up on parts of ourself so that there's not coherence, so that there's not a through line to our experience. And again, it's not a perfect through line. I can see those of you, there's three faces I've seen where there was applying of judging. Now people are going to come up and say, was mine one of the faces? I'm not going to tell you. Come on. But this is not a self-judging. It's not that kind of experience. It's more the heart's relating to its own desire to be authentic. It's a heart's experience. It's not the judging, comparing, fixing mind. I'm pointing to a very different feeling around this. And I hope that my aspiration would be a better word to say it. My aspiration was to be self-disclosing in a way that would help model that. So any questions or comments here?
I was in a movement workshop one time where the teacher was sort of exhorting us to move authentically, to be authentic. And a friend of mine in class, who happens to be an actor also, came out with a wisecrack, but it stuck with me because he quick as a flash says, I can do authentic. Doing it, but you know, there was something about the intention in that crack.
Yeah, so
it stuck with me.
So I'm going to repeat it for the tape that you were in a movement class and there was a friend who was an actor in the class and the teacher said, be authentic in your movement, and the actor said, oh, I can be authentic.
I
can do authentic. Yes, yeah, and that of course is one method. Method acting and be this doing authentic. By the way, one of the things that happened with my thing is that my left eye will just start watering, and it just kind of waters here on its own at times. And yes, we can all do authentic. Sometimes that's the best we can do. Is doing authentic rather than being authentic. And if that's the best we can do, that's the best we can do. But the danger is in believing that when we're doing authentic, that we're being authentic. It's very in certain circles around, you know, I'm going to get real, we're going to have hot seats, we're going to have all this, you know, to think they're being authentic when many times people are doing authenticity but not being authentic. And that's okay as a learning method, but being very careful about believing You know, that is authentic. It's a whole different feeling than doing. So thank you for that remark.
There, when I listen to, you know, where does this place of authenticism come from, it sort of reverberates, well, is there a place, an I, or a center that isn't subject to the whims of outrageous fortune or whatever? You know, and I don't know that, you know, because there... to find that place to where you're being authentic from amongst the winds that are shifting here and there, I don't know that I've got that place. I mean, somebody, I can shift because of whatever.
So his statement was about where does authenticity come from, and his experience is trying to find that place. It's not so easy, and sometimes he doesn't know if he can, because there's so many shifting winds of what would maybe feel like authentic in a moment. And yes, this is a challenge, and that's why I said it's from a heart place, not a head place. It's from our earned, lived experience of and by staying present and having this intention of being as real with ourselves as we can be over and over and over again. We're in relationship to being. We're directly in relationship to being authentic. How well we're doing that can vary a lot. But that sense of, no, I am authentic in this becomes known. The heart knows it. The heart knows it, in my experience. Not every moment, but there's times there can be days that you're completely unreal with yourself. You don't know if you're real or not real, blah, 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 all this. But that there's just general overall this through line that we come back to. That is my experience of that. But again, a very good exploration.
Well, authenticity doesn't mean positiveness. I'm just thinking about negative emotions can be very authentic.
Oh, sure.
You know, it doesn't mean that it's
right. And so you can be authentic around having really like being very angry or being very sad or being wanting like crazy, like, you know, lusting after something, resentful of something, aging, you know, health issues, whatever. But then you're having a... Then, but the authenticness is that this is what I'm feeling. The Dharma authenticity is, and I seek to have a wise relationship. I authentically seek to have a wise relationship with these negative emotions. So in this whole month plus experience now, I have not been caught in objecting to what I've gone through. I can say that is an authentic experience. I have not liked it, but I have not contracted into not wanting this way. The closest to that has been my sort of embarrassment that I'm having such an extreme, because I also got a secondary infection. So I've had to take huge antibiotics, and it's actually a little unclear what could happen still, because I'm just off the antibiotics, and if it didn't get rid of it, then I've got a whole other series of problems to face. But I have not, I found myself being unreal and like I'm a little embarrassed to have had so much things over. It's just a tooth thing, like, you know, and I've had so many tooth things. How could this be? So I was a little embarrassed over that. That embarrassment was a false self. It was not, I did not want to be seen or something in that way. That was not real. But I was very real about my not realness. See what I mean? And I three or four times, I've said to someone, oh, this is so much over such a little thing. And I was doing it, positioning myself, right, with them. I was positioning myself, but who I was ultimately positioning myself with was myself. But I knew it the whole time. So maybe you would do the same thing and not know it the whole time. When you know it, now you've come back to authenticity. One more question from this side of the room. You, because I don't know you. So.
I almost don't know how to phrase this, but is it okay to feel pleasure when you are authentic, whether negatively or positively?
Is it okay to feel centered?
Pleasure.
Yeah, so, you know, the Buddha was not against pleasure. That was not that happiness and well-being. He has, in one sutta, there's this whole list about the forms of happiness, so, and particularly for lay people. So it is being authentic. So there's happiness of conditions. Then there's happiness of the state of your mind, both of which are temporary. And then there's this happiness of liberation. So there's three kinds of happiness in that way, in my view of things. So teaching that's slightly different than the Buddha taught it. The happiness of conditions, why wouldn't you be happy when the conditions are favorable? I'll certainly be happy if I don't end up with another round of this, because those are favorable conditions. It's the attachment to the happiness that's the problem, you see. It's attachment, it's clinging, it's grasping, it's letting go. That's what gets us into greed and hatred and delusion, not whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. And we can be authentic in our pleasantness and our unpleasant moments and our deluded moments to some degree when we know we're deluded. There are times we don't know we're deluded, but there's many times we know we're deluded. So in the course of this time with taking all this medication, I would say my mind isn't working well. I would say this to someone. You know, I actually had to write this long, detailed thing, and I said at the beginning of this, you've got to really look at this carefully, because my mind makes mistakes in a way that people aren't used to my mind making mistakes. My mind's making mistakes now. So that's the truth. So I said it to them, because I didn't want us to take my little complicated plan and go implement it, and it had some huge error in it, which I ordinarily would not have that kind of uncertainty. But the authenticness of the experience was, it's not reliable right now. So then that the same reason I didn't have the address and all. My mind was not, in the midst of all of this, has not been the way it has usually been. My mind might be like that from now on. Then I would adjust to that. But that's the being real with ourselves, being authentic, is like you're seeing if you're really grasping to this pleasantness. You go, and then the Buddha says, just see it over and over again. Is that grasping adding anything to the pleasant, to the pleasure? If you watch it for any sustained period of time, you will see that the clinging, the grasping, does not add one iota to your happiness. It, in fact, detracts from it. But this you have to see for yourself. This is not a philosophical statement. This is a suggestion for inquiry. And so we start to see what clinging and grasping does to the mind, as the Buddha taught us. And we realize that it's not skillful. We'd rather not have it. Although it's very tempting because of the soap opera, because if we're really grasping, that gives us so much interest in little small things where we're clinging to them. It's seductive, but it does not have any sustainable gain in terms of well-being. More on another talk some other time about that. Lots of talks about this. So we need to stop.